almost what they call ad nauseum. It's a very fascinating topic, and I've devoted 12 years of my life to it. I don't think that you have to hear all 12. And we've chewed the fat on a variety of issues. I'm not saying that hasn't been interesting. It's been interesting for me, and I trust that I understand from the feedback that it's interesting to other people as well. What I'd like to do is, I'd like to try to plow through. Let's just sort of move through the issues as fast as we can, instead of chewing the fat. And then afterwards, as we get into it, you want to raise some other issues, we can do so. Okay? There were a couple of halakhic questions on tefillah. There was a very famous professor who was in the States, who my parents actually adopted, then he made Aliyah. Her name is Professor Gerald Tauber. Professor Gerald Tauber. And then when I was a little boy, my parents adopted him, and he was the first physicist in my life. First person I knew who was really a scientist. And he used to come over all the time, and we would have, when he first came over, I would sit on his knee, and we had a question and answer period. You know, it would be Fragen und Fragen. He would say something in German, something like that. And I would sit on his knee, and I could ask him all sorts of things about this, about the clouds, and it was really very interesting. Anyway, so we're going to have a question and answer period. I'll ask the questions. Most of the questions I assume are about tefillah, but things we do. So I would ask a question: where in the davening can you interrupt? I mean, you're davening, and all of a sudden the kids are screaming, or interrupting, and the phone rings, or somebody comes to the front door. Where are the places? So let's first determine what you're davening. Okay. If you take the minimalist position that I've given you, which is you say brachot, and then you'll jump say, maybe you say Kriya Shema without the Birkot Kriya Shema. I'll tell you why. You just say Kriya Shema, and then you say Shemona Esrei, and that's such Shemona Esrei Shacharit. Because we didn't really talk about Hallel, but Hallel you're not obligated, because it's the mitzvah to say Shazman Gama. The only Hallel you're probably Chayim is the Hallel of the Seder, because then you're Chayim and everything. But the Hallel of every Yom Tov you're freed from, because the mitzvah to say Shazman Gama. So you don't have to say that. You don't have to say Musaf, because it's a mitzvah to say Shazman Gama. Beside the fact that I'm talking about the minimalist position, you want to be a tzidkon as gay as a day. We talked about it. No, what is it, the minimal, okay? What's the minimal position? So Musaf also your putter from? So really down to very little. So in the Birkat HaShachar, anywhere after a bracha, okay, you can talk. In between the Birkat HaShachar, you can talk. Okay, there's no halachic problem there. In the Shemoneh Esrei, you clearly can't talk. And if some crisis comes up, so as you're coming and your kid, let's say, fell on the floor, and you, in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei, you're allowed to run over to the kid, to assuage it. If you talk, you got to start Shemoneh Esrei over again. If you didn't talk, you said, no, even though you walked, it's all right. Okay, but if you talk, then you mafsik in Shemoneh Esrei, and you got over again. I'm not saying that Kosh Baruch Hu doesn't understand, it's a crisis situation. I'm just saying what the halacha says as far as, when is it a hefsek? When have you interrupted? Netzos interrupt. Okay, to the best of my knowledge, I should think it. The best of my knowledge, if you talk, that's a half second. You have to start over again. You're not allowed to interrupt it. But let me check it again. That's a good question. So as you're not only mafsik, but you were mafsik, is that enough that requires you to start Shemoneh Esrei over again, or do you have to go back to the beginning of bracha? My impression is, off speaking off the top of my head, this is that prayer is that you have to start Shemoneh Esrei over again. But that deserves some checking. Okay, now, if you've decided to say Hallel, okay, you're not supposed to interrupt in Hallel. Because there's a brach in the beginning, there's a brach in the end, and the rest, you're not supposed to be master. The rules for full Hallel and half Hallel are the same as far as other interruptions, but as far as talking and shooting, talking and concern, you're not supposed to be. That's supposed to be master. What? Yeah, but you notice the Hallel is consciously interrupted. Chazal did it on purpose. They put the suda in the middle, because the Chazal are trying to give us a message that the suda is part of the shevach, the hodoyat Hashem. The suda is part of the shevach. Talking about the Seder, having a good time, is part of the shevach to Hashem. That's the experience. Chazal did it on purpose. But that's the only case, really, that you're allowed to do that stuff. sure the brisket is probably good. Probably for this, I'm just kidding. Saying, I don't know for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if they're very careful. I know the briskers don't talk from all the whole suda anyway, because al achilat matzah at the beginning also goes on the akhikomen, and they don't talk. Okay, so we rely on the idea, we rely on their view that once you've done the mitzvah, once you've eaten the matzah, even though the matzah it has continuation. That it's not a problem. We've talked, for instance, about Bidikat Chametz. We have the custom, most people have the custom, they don't talk during Bidikat Chametz. And they hold the bracha goes on the whole Bidika. Mitzat Adin, once you started the Bidika, right, and if some hefse comes up that you got to do, it's not a problem. But we're Machmer. We tend to be Machmer, not to talk the whole time, and we don't talk. The only thing that's mutter is things that are le'inyan b'dika. That is, if you say, move the couch, I gotta see what's behind it. All those that are le'inyan b'dika, okay, that's the general policy. But mitzad b'diyaban, somebody talk, it's not a problem. It's not you don't have to make a problem here.
What I wanted to know is about moving. If I'm saying the Shmona Esrei, and I'm standing in a particular position, I'm not supposed to move
no,
either.
No, you're not supposed to.
That's what I was
except
that's
in a crisis situation, which is disturbing your kavanah. That's a crisis situation, disturbing kavanah, for instance. Suppose you're davening. You're not allowed to daven when you smell your kid's full diaper. So that's a problem. You can't daven when your kid's diaper's full. Okay? So if that's something that's disturbing your kavanah, you may be able to put the kid in the playpen and move someplace else so that you can continue davening. Well, you do. I mean, it's not a crisis situation. And mothers are used to their kids crying.
Okay.
I mean, Saturday you probably could take it off. Yeah. If you really want to. Yes, you could. Yes. If it, because that's disturbing your kavanah.
But if you take it off before you start, then it makes a terrible noise.
I will teach you a secret. No, the little plug that goes into the receiver, then connect it.
Don't take that part out.
It drives them crazy, but no. You're fine.
I would disconnect the phone. That's
yeah, that's
a
okay. All right. Let's now, we talk, okay. Let's talk about, to summarize very, 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 very quickly. We discussed the major complaints of Herschel Schechter's school as far as women's prayer groups. The first one was the incomplete fulfillment of mitzvot, and we argued at great length that, and proved from several cases, in fact, even from that principle, the Magen Avraham that he quoted, that women are not obligated in Kriyat HaTorah, women are not obligated in Tefillah B'Tzibur, and even though they indeed lose these things, and that's an objective fact, they will lose all these, the possibility of Tefillah B'Tzibur, they, however, cannot be held culpable because they're not chayim. And if you're not chayiv, you can't scream and shrug about, why didn't you do it? I'm not chayiv. You can't do anything. Not only that, one could argue, and this led us to a discussion about a question, one woman could argue, for me, tefillah b'tzibur is a hidden mitzvah. I'm not obligated. Kavanah has a greater priority. I feel I have greater kavanah, woman's service. Okay, and then we got off into a discussion, well, is my subjective feeling of kavanah equal to an objective kiyum mitzvah of tefillah b'tzibur? We thrashed that back and forth. It was not a clear point. As we mentioned, sort of Soloveitchik felt that it was not a comparable situation. We'll come back to our Soloveitchik position again. But at least that was a point of discussion. But clearly women cannot say no to them if they're not obligated. If you're not obligated, you don't have to do it. They can't be held culpable. Now, essentially what we said was that Schechter's argument was a call to saintliness. And you can't fault women for not responding to this call of saintliness. I have the Torah, the Halacha gave me the freedom, I have the right to use that freedom. Then we talked about our second argument that Rav Schechter used was Ziyuf HaTorah, which means a misrepresentation. And we argued it's not Ziyuf HaTorah if the women say this is not a minyan. I mean, if they had argued, and I'm not getting, there's a lot of more technicalism when the article comes out any day, any second, when the article comes out, you'll see there's a lot, very long technical discussion about what exactly is Ziyufa Torah and what are the rules and why it really doesn't apply. But the claim as such is not a fair claim, because the women in these prayer services do not claim that they're a minyan. And the fact that some people get a misimpression is not their fault. They're very verbal about the fact that they are not, that they are not a woman's minyan, but a woman's tefillah group. And in all the writings and all the publications, it's clear that they wished it were. And they don't make bones about that either. They wished it were a minyan, but they clearly say it's not. Now, the third argument that Rav Shechter uses is the concept of Verov Am Hadlach Melech. Verov Am Hadlach Melech means that one should not split a prayer community. That's halachic concept. In each of Rav Shechter's arguments, he's using it as a halachic argument. Now, you can also have social intonation, social perspective on it. We'll come back to these later. But we're dealing with Rav Shechter as he presented it, which was halachic argument. And that is, for instance, a person can't go up and split a prayer community because I don't like the color of the rabbi's suit. It's not a halachic problem. Is that grounds for splitting a prayer community? I don't like the rabbi's drushes. I don't like the rare rabbi who wears brown suits. I think he should wear black suits.
So what about
right?
I don't like his hashkafa? I don't like the mussar he gives on the
That might be grounds for firing the rabbi.
No, excuse me.
I'm saying, at least you should realize that the halacha clearly does take into consideration, it's a halachic consideration, the size of the prayer community, and one should not go around splitting a prayer community. And I should point out to you that this is a major argument against things like shtiglach and all sorts of break off minyanim. It's not a simple consideration. For instance, an early minyan, which everybody thinks is a trivial problem, is not a trivial problem. The post can deal with it because it contradicts Barov HaMadrat Melech. Now one could argue, well, I prefer Zrizin Makdim in the Mitzvot, and I prefer davening earlier, it gives me more opportunity to daven. You have to use contrary halachic arguments, but it is a barrier that has to be overcome. Argues Rav Shechter, women breaking off to set up their own prayer community contravenes the principle of the Barov HaMadrat Melech.
Well, why would it at all? Because the whole concept of the prayer community for a minyan is a male prayer community, so what difference does it make whether the women...
So essentially what you're essentially saying is if I don't have to be there at all, can't argue against me, Barov HaMadrat Melech. Rav HaMadrat Melech applies, somebody's got to be there. I don't have to be there. And again, you can't hold against me if I don't have to be there in the first place. Okay, again, now, so the question is, prove it to me. So prove it to me.
But if you're going to go, that's where you should go.
But that's what you argue. But I can, let's prove it. But,
no, I mean, then you join the big
excuse me.
Can you join the big
That's a good argument, but that clearly is part of what Schechter is arguing. I admit that that's... But the question is, if I leave my house, do I have a right to go to my neighbor's house? You tell me I have no right to leave my neighbor's house? So you can't tell me where I'm going to go. The law gave me the freedom to do as I like. I do as I like. I don't see the argument.
It's a communal decision, though.
What? Let me rephrase what you're saying in a different way. He says, the women don't have a problem. The community. Is their decision not to go to the shul affects the community's Barov HaMadrat Melech.
No, I don't see it.
She's not obligated. Am I saying what you want to say? She's not obligated Barov HaMadrat Melech. Right? But it has clear repercussions on the community. The communities, there will be less people dominating that community.
So you simply say
the women don't count for Barov HaMadrat Melech. They have no effect. If they don't have to be there, they don't count. Now that's a big machlokes. Okay. So let me tell you where we have to deal with this. Okay? We have to discuss this in some, we need some halachic anchor. And the halachic anchor is Purim. The rule is by Megillah particularly, because of Pirsumei Nisa, we're very machbid on Barov HaMadrat Melech. you should preferably go to the biggest shul possible. The Sezer of Menashe Klein, if that's true, how come in all sorts of communities in Europe, in fact in Shulchan Aruch, the halacha states, when the husband comes home for shul, he should read from his wife. Why weren't the women to pour out to the shuls? Barabbanan was so mocked by Megillah reading. You should go to the biggest shul possible. You should be the biggest person. Why don't you say that? Why does it say when the husband goes home, he reads from the wife?
Maybe
you understand? Women don't. What?
Maybe they weren't able.
To. She should come to shul. So one argument, okay? So said Menashe Klein, you see that the halacha considered as normative and not problematic the fact that women stayed home from Megillah reading. Essentially argues Rav Menashe Klein, if women have no problem about Rav Madrat Miller. If they don't have to be there, the community has no complaint against them, they don't have to show up.
But there's a question is how you define community. If you define community only as the religious forum needed to make a minyan for davening, then women are excluded from the community, therefore not a part of the community. Yeah. But if you call the community all of Klal Yisrael, you're including women, okay, then where, I don't see.
That's exactly, right. There are poskim, I'm trying to, off the hand, and there are many poskim who say that that's not so. The women definitely do contribute to the Baruch HaMadra Melech. Their presence, and their presence is crucial to the sense, in fact, the Chaya Adam says, that when a man goes to shul, he should make sure that he takes his wife and his children, because everybody is a Baruch HaMadrat Melech. I'm not talking about in a social, let me just sort of rephrase this. On a halakhic perspective, I think the bottom line is clear for most of the poskim, that I can't hold it against the women if they decide not to show up. I can't criticize them. They're not chayiv in Baruch HaMadrat Melech, And therefore, just as they're not chayiv in minyan, essentially the idea would be similar. But nevertheless, when they're there, they contribute. I don't think there's any doubt that one of the things that makes an communal experience like Purim so special is by the fact that everybody's there, that people come in costume, that the kids are there.
But it's an exception to the rule.
It's not that's not clear. That's not clear. Maybe that's the case, the test that proves the rule. Do women, who even though they're not obligated to Baruch HaMelech, contribute to the Baruch HaMelech? And many there's a clear distinction amongst the poskim.
But maybe, yes, whether or not they're obligated to Baruch HaMelech depends on whether or not they're obligated for this type of tshuva. Mm-hmm. Women
good.
Are obligated for Megillah. Maybe
point.
For that they are obligated, but
good
not
point.
For the
excellent point. Excellent point. You may be right. But you see that the issue is not a trivial one. But I would say, the bottom line, and that's because that's Megillah, that's essentially what you were arguing, that this may be an exception to the rule because the women are obligated.
That's right.
Your point is well taken. But I would say the bottom line is that women, since they are not obligated in the the women are not obligated in the communal aspects of any of them, so it'll be a minyan. Or Baruch HaMadrat Melech, which is also a communal concept, they may contribute to it, but they do not obligated, and therefore you can't hold it against
them. But how do you contribute to it if we're supposed to remain so passive active?
No, it's the fact that everybody's there. By your very presence. What does Baruch HaMadrat Melech mean? It means that the glory of the king is in the multitudes. So the question is, if the king comes to town, does everybody have to show up? Do people have to the house and show up? Balacha says no. The men have the obligation to show up. So there's no question that you have, instead of 1,000, you have 2,000 people. The glory, that there's greater glory in the Kodesh Baruch Hu. I agree with you. That's exactly what.
She's saying.
Okay, I would say that Rav Menashe Klein attempts to point out that maybe women are not obligated to their minyan. They don't have to worry about Rav HaMadrat Melech. He says that the normative situation was that they didn't.
I thought that was what Shevich
said. Yeah. Besides, we demonstrated that many people know they should have the minyan, right? And that they constitute the minyan. So that sort of doesn't present the problem. That's again Megillah. Megillah is a different situation. Okay.
That's why I said it may be an exception.
Yes, yes, and exactly what Shelley said, and made the point clear. Okay. Let's now go to the next criticism of the women's prayer service, and that was a departure from normative Judaism. Okay, and that's not a trivial question. Okay, departure from normative Judaism. Now, essentially, let's get down to what the nitty gritty halachic issue is. Because after all, we could ask this about a great many things. Bat mitzvah, is that a departure from normative Judaism? It certainly was. In the 50s, when I first came to Israel, which was in the early 60s, okay, I went to Kfar Ro'eh, actually went to Givat Chazon, which is the American community. There was one of the young ladies there was having a bat mitzvah, and that was creating a tremendous stir. From a very firm family was having a bat mitzvah, and I remember they said, "Well, the Americans they can do it." The Americans can do it. But I remember that not long after that, Israel. As a whole, bat mitzvah became more acceptable in Israel way before they were acceptable in the States. And they were doing them in Israel. And part of the reason for it was that it received the blessing of Avadi Yosef. Part of the reason is Avadi Yosef gave it his blessings. And he said that it's a positive thing. But in the post-game discussing it in the States, one of the issues raised was it's strong departure from normative Judaism. So what does that mean? I mean, what type of argument is that? So they didn't do it, so now we do it. It's a big deal. What's the problem? The problem is minha. And let's analyze it more specifically. The fact that something is not done, does that mean that there's a minute not to do it? Or the phrase in the halach terms, lo ra'inu raya b'minhag, o eino raya b'minhag. That's the essential issue. That is, the fact that we don't see something done, does that mean that there's a minhag that's not to do it? Or does that mean, that it doesn't mean that there's a minhag to do it?
Well, that would turn into like a Hasidic dress. That there is a minhag. There's no halach in the dress. This is a
minhag of
a certain
age,
right?
Yeah, the question was...
So the point is that if we don't do it, right?
The question is, why don't we do it?
Why don't we do it? We don't have that minhag, right?
No, well, yeah, but the question is, let me analyze this particular sugya. Lo ra'inu hayab minhag, or lo ra'inu eino hayab minhag. It's not a proof. In fact, you don't see something, does prove something, or doesn't prove something. The poskim thrashed this argument back and forth. Okay, and remember, this would apply to every innovation, women's hakafa, women's Megillah reading, anything that would be an innovation, this is a fundamental issue. According to the view of lo ra'inu eino ra'ya, there's no problem. But according to the view lo ra'inu ra'ya, even according to this, that view, the community's passive behavior creates a minhag only when such an action resulted from a deliberate and conscious decision. We can demonstrate that the community decided not to act. It's not sufficient that the community simply did not act. Again, it has to decide, it has to will not to act. And that's what you have to prove. It is if there were no bat mitzvah because it was will, they say, no, you don't do bat mitzvah. If they said, no, we don't do bat mitzvah, it's never been done, why it should rock the boat?
How do you define bat mitzvah? What do you
mean? That's a good question. Celebrating in any form. Okay, you're asking a good point, because one of the reasons, I mean, part of the problem, in any form, having a party, having a bat mitzvah party. What? It was never done. Excuse me, you're living in the wrong generation, Lee. You take all these things for granted.
So
you have to know, you should know that as far back as the 1950s, it was a major issue. It was a major issue.
They didn't celebrate birthdays either. So does that mean that we can't celebrate birthdays because they didn't?
Such a good
song. Yes, it's the contrary. They looked at it as a day of atonement, sort of. Certainly not to celebrate.
I don't know. I'm not so sure that that was. That was I horror situations. It was a. I don't think it was.
I find that there's a big difference between minhag and halakha. There's a big difference between the two. One.
Oh, no question. But minhag has halakhic status. That's not so. If the community will say, we decide that we're not going to do bat mitzvahs, we're not going to have women's Megillah readings, that's fine. That you'd have to demonstrate.
Who says we do?
Essentially, there was a community. I mean, look, in the modern period, that's a very difficult question to answer. Because community is so fragmented, because the world is so small, the world is expanding, people are transferring back and forth all the time. And that has all sorts of halakhic ramifications. Until World War II, it was pretty clear to know the community. You've been raised in your shtetl, you know what your shtetl was. And in fact, the mixture that comes up is because people still keep what they did in their shtetl, right? But in the shtetl, it was very clear what the minhag was. You knew what you did from the moment you got up, the moment you died, tradition, you knew. And Philon Ruth knew, he knew, Philon Ruth, exactly what his goal in life was, and what he was to do, and what his wife was to do, and that's it. Now, they lived in societies that were closed in, both internally and externally. The Goyim didn't let them mix, and the Jews held them tight because they burial rights and communal rights and all these things. The communities are very tight. We live in an open society, in a much more voluntary society. And we mix, you don't like this, but you go to the next minute. You can shop and choose for him and hug it for your communities for, they talk them down, don't talk them down. Eat before Shabbat, don't eat before Shabbat. And you can eat, because every community has like 50,000 different minhagim. It wasn't that way. It was a constant to go to do, and you kept one, every bedding had, and every community kept its own. One of the major things that changed things very drastically, and I'm sort of going off on a major tangent here, but it's very important. One of the major things that changed that was yeshivas. Yeshivas said, you come from a particular community, forget what your minhag was, you do what yeshivas did. And for a long time, and that's how Lachaim Voloshin, but then it began spreading like wildfire. For the long time, the Rav of the Shtot was the Rosh Yeshiva of that Shtot, for that city. And of course, he knew what the community was, and everybody who lived in that community, if they had a yeshiva, they lived in the community. It was a perpetuation. But now, when Lachaim Voloshin set up the superstructure, yeshiva, sort of floating in cloud seven, and supported by all of Klal Yisrael, and they come now, the yeshiva now has its community, sort of extraterritorial, and they have their own minhag. That sort of created a great deal of confusion. So people from Brisk would go, people from one city, Hatzafatz, would come to Brisk, and then they would have to, they would keep the minhag in Brisk, and then they went back to the towns. They said, my Rosh Yeshiva went to you, going to tell me, my Rosh Yeshiva told me this is what we do. And that sort of created a tremendous amount of confusion. And
World War II.
Okay, we'll anyway, that's this has a great evolution. So the question is not a trivial question you're asking me. I would generally say the minhag. There are minhagim which are minhag Eretz Israel. There are minhagim or minhagei Edot. And it's clear that we, the shul, are very different than the rest of the city. And I mean it very seriously, and certain things that we consider acceptable or not acceptable. The question is, we live in it's a very different society than the halacha pictured until the modern period. And already the Mishnah Berurah is beginning to struggle with this. And the Rosh Hashulchan, by the end of the 1800s, we're going to have to struggle with this problem.
Are you
really
different from the rest of the world?
I don't want to get into it. Please.
How do you decide?
What's acceptable in this community? What's acceptable?
Arya, how do you tell where...
Excuse me, a shir like this would never go anyplace else.
How do you tell the difference?
This type of shir?
Between a minhag that's based on halakha,
yeah,
and a minhag that's socially generated.
I mean, the fact that people actually... Because a lot of it has to do with the post we discussed about.
Because some in Chagim are not halakhically based.
Yes, you're right.
So how do you tell which is which?
Right, I mean, I don't think that every time somebody says poo, 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 that makes it a halakha.
That's right.
I understand that. I understood you right away. I think, the fact that the post can discuss certain minhagim and discuss it within halakhic terminology, that brings it into the halakhic fabric. So, again, I think that we have to understand that the question of bat mitzvah, and if you look at Yechiel Weinberg's tshuva on bat mitzvah, he essentially says this. See what Avadi is saying. Those the proponents of bat mitzvah essentially say that. That lo ve'inu, either we say lo ve'inu einu raya, or even if you hold those words lo ve'inu raya, women didn't feel the need for bat mitzvah. It wasn't a major issue. Right? Women had, for the many, many years, accepted their passive role, and it was only with, certainly in the 1920s, with the the suffragettes and the like, but even the suffragettes were willing to swallow a great deal. But as you move in the modern period after World War II, and that was the major thing, when the men went off to war and women took the jobs that men had, doing all the men's jobs, and then when the men came back and tried to tell the women, "I'm sorry, go home," the women said, "No." And that was a major, major crisis. There been a lot of interesting kosher movies written about this problem, this particular social problem. There have been books written about it. That was a very fascinating period. What did these women do when they were told to go home? And I've seen ads in the government on ads to go back home and have children and all, seriously, to go home and have children and the thing. But that was the point where many, many women started marching. I mean, it was always true, I think if you think about this, it was true for a very long time that the husband earned the living and the mother stayed home. What forced the women out was World War II. And after World War II, many of these women decided finding they wanted to have careers.
But this problem is a sociological one that you're discussing now, had to do with the change that was worldwide and not necessarily directly involving Am Yisrael.
But it did, because what happened was that women, as is happening now, what's causing the halakhic feminist movement? Women are saying, you want me to run, I can run businesses, I can run universities, I can run banks, and I can't run the davening. Uh-huh. I need an intermediary. Okay? That creates a different satisfaction. Now, if you're raised in a halakhic framework, where you're saying, well, look, the rules are different. Here, the question has to do with chiyuv, and not with chiyuv, and you're willing to think. But if you're not halakhic oriented, but goal oriented, you say, it's not fair. Right? So you can say, well, halakha has a different priority. I mean, I can judge, but the question is a question. And the push comes from that. Right? The fact that what the experiences that women have in the open secular marketplace are radically different than the experiences they're feeling and the ego satisfaction, or spiritual satisfaction, the confrontation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that they'd like to have that they don't have in the synagogue.
But then can halakha, as it's interpreted by the different poskim in modern times,
yes,
adapt itself,
yes,
to these sociological external changes?
I would argue, we're getting to a really very far field, but this is the crux of the issue. The answer is the halakha can. Okay, the halakha can, but it's got to work.
You're essentially making new law.
Let me give you an answer to that question, because it's, I think, the fundamental question. The answer is yes, the halakha can. The halakha can. However, it will not give you quick fixes. You have to be very patient. Why? Because the halakha has, in its filtering process, has to filter out things that are extraneous issues. Because I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I want to help my women get their spiritual satisfaction as possible. And that will be a struggle, because Judaism has, to a great extent, lasted because it doesn't blow with every wind. It maintains its, and we have to test the waters. Is this going too far? Is it not going too far? It's going to take a while. If you don't have the patience, you want freedom now, you're not going to get it. You're not going to get it now, okay? Because we have higher, other priorities that we want to guard. We want to guard the family, we want to guard Lima the Torah, we want to guard respect for halacha, we don't want people to think that halacha changes at every whim, not making demand. No. The fundamental question is, and let me just give you, which we didn't deal with yet, one of the fundamental issues is a prayer group going to be around another generation? But why should I make all these compensations for women's prayer groups? But it may not be around another generation. There's already evidence, and I mentioned this before, that the daughters of the women who are involved in women's prayer groups, they're not going to prayer groups. They're going to prayer groups for bat mitzvah. They go three times a year. The daughters who grew up of the mothers who founded the women's prayer group, their high is a limit of Torah. Okay, to put it differently, they don't want to be chazaniyot, they want to be poskot. That's where they're going to. In fact, our Soloveitchik, already in the 70s, when he was asked about this issue, he said, they're wasting their time. That's not the way to change things. Do you want to change things in Judaism? You do it through halacha. You do it through psak. That's the way of the top. It's always been the way of the top. That's where he devoted. And he marked into stern and he stood up the first of the money. So that's the way to change things. Right? But you have to do within halacha. What?
Is that
Excuse me, Soloveitchik's opinion was that women should get involved in halacha. The issue of women being poskot is really a minor issue. And we'll talk about
it. It's not so minor.
It's a minor issue.
Why?
Because the halacha already passed in that. That women can be poskot. It's already in poskot. I mean, the poskot already said women can pass it. There's no problem with the women passing it.
If they know what the halacha is in a particular situation, they can say what the halacha is. That's
right. The question is, it's not connected to dayanut, that's no good. Halacha is based on fact, establishing fact. If I can argue, Bruy and the Gemara argue. The wife of the Isma, when it's ever married to them, past conditions, left and right. If you know halacha, halacha. There's always a question of the Maril Diskin wife. You know, the people would come in and they would ask Gisha, and then as on the way out, the Maril Diskin's wife would say, I know my husband was Mecca, but if you ask me, you should be fine. She was a very forceful woman, and she didn't always agree with her husband's fact. She was a very, very knowledgeable woman. Look, I don't want to say, what I'm trying to point out here, on that particular, but let's deal with that as a separate issue, okay? Let's finish up with this prayer. We'll talk about women and leadership roles in the Jewish community and psak, and then we'll get to it. We're being rabbis, I don't duck, but that's an issue at a time. So on the issue of lo reino eino raya, so it seems pretty clear that the issue of lo reino eino raya, okay, or raya, while it's thrown around a great deal, the fact of the matter is, it's clear the women's reason why there were no women's milgiris in the 20th century was they didn't know Trump. And many of the women barely knew how to read. And why would they learn Trump? They didn't need Trump to daven and shul, so why would they learn just to learn the Megillah? Okay, well, in our generation, when women are much more knowledgeable, and many women learn Trump, not because of the daven, because they want to know how to set the words. And Trump is very important. Pshat, and the teachers and the like. Or like my mother-in-law, they learned Trump because they were the bar mitzvah teachers. A lot of women learned it, right? A lot of women learned it, and there's no reason why they, so that became a social, that became, the fact that women didn't do it doesn't ruin anything. The fact that we're not bar mitzvah, there was no need for it. And when the women begin to express a need for it, to celebrate their bat mitzvah, the poskim, many reputable poskim fought it. Many reputable, because it was not normative, they were afraid, it was an open offender. Many other poskim came out gung ho, amongst them, about you say, Rav Waldenberg and Rav Moshe was very neutral, but he's very neutral about bar mitzvah, too. That's neat here. All right, so on that issue is not a major problem. The fact of the matter, however, is that it's not true that there were no women's prayer groups before. First of all, very interesting, when on the Pasuk, Ashirat Hayam, the Pasuk says, Ashir l'Hashem ki go'o ga'asus v'chvo l'ma v'yam, and you know that Miriam went out, and she led the women, and the Medrash says, there are several Medrashim bring that the word ga'o ga'a in Gematria is 18, isn't it? Gimel Aleph Hey, right? Gimel Aleph Hey, is 9 and 9, the Oga is 18, that she led the woman like a chazan leads Shmon Esrei. The major says it. The other poskim, that we know that throughout the Middle Ages, there was an institution called the Fazogiri. Now, this is not a clear proof, but there was an, what is a Fazogiri? These were women who were knowledgeable. It was called Fazogiri, Nazogika. These were women who led other women in Tchinot and prayers. Most of the women were illiterate. She davened out loud, and the other women would repeat after her, and she said she led the women. Now, this is not exactly a woman's prayer service, but she led, she clearly davened for the women. She would lead them in Tchinot. She would lead them in Tilim. So there were, what?
On the other side of the Mechitza.
That was in the men's section of the Mechitza. Well,
the
men's? No, the women's, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
the women's section. But what is, unfortunately, I didn't bring it with me, but one of the real coup de grace, and unfortunately I didn't bring it with me, it says, Rav Mashash in his book quotes an old tradition that he had that the women in Spain, they'd get up much earlier than their husbands, and they'd go to shul, and they'd daven together, and they'd go to Sefer Torah. I mean, really, he quotes it, Rav Mashash was the chief rabbi of Haifa, Sephardi chief rabbi of Haifa. Remember I told you I was looking for the book? I don't remember. That was right. Okay. Now, Bashash, in one of his books, actually quotes that there was a tradition that in, at least in some, he meant quotes in Spain, that there was a tradition that women had prayer groups. That they would get up and they would daven earlier, and they would, then they would go back and they would prepare the coffee for the husbands and wait at the husbands. So there seemed to be some tradition about it. And besides the fact that clearly we know that in the modern period there are a great many schools, Hasabiyot, and an educational framework. Now that's not exactly a good analogy, because an educational framework is not necessarily a normative prayer situation. But it didn't bother anybody. It really didn't bother anybody for the longest time that the girls were davening together. The major problem came around, what was the major issue? If you look where the issue came, the resistance came to the prayer groups. So it wasn't the fact that they didn't have it. It's because they took up the Sefer Torah. That was the issue that sort of, quote unquote, broke the canvas back, that caused the greatest resistance. It was the issue, and I would argue that it sort of raised all sorts of flags. It raised the flag of conservative reform, it raised the flag of that's been radically different than anything that was done. That was really the change that that created the major problems.
Did you see that at the same time that you started with
Talit?
Or did
you start
with
Talit
people?
No, that didn't. Some women, not with a very minor group. That's a very minor group that works at Talit. That's not a major issue for most women. I don't know, women write Talit and Kippot. We'll talk about it, but that's really, for at least for the women's prayer group, that's a minor. The next issue that Rav Shachter talks about is the question of ubechukotem lo telechu. Chukotem lo telechu is a provision to emulate the religious mores, the religious practices of non-Jews and their immodest mores. That is, what are the grounds under which to wear miniskirts? Okay. One of the grounds against wearing miniskirts is not only the issue of a tzniut issue, but if you look at the poskim, they say it's, you're following the immodest mores of the non-Jews. It's an isur doraita. See, tzniut may be only isur d'rabbanan, but that's an isur doraita. So mimicking the non-Jews and their immodest mores, that's an isur doraita. And where Schechter's group, school, argues that where did this all come from? Where do the women's prayer groups all come from? If not from women's lib. And women's lib is interested in doing away with differentiation of the sexes. And women's lib is interested is burning the bra and all sorts of free love and all sorts of, all that stuff comes together. And that's part of where this, all this stuff is coming from. So they argue that's part of, it's an attempt to obfuscate and obliterate all male of female sex roles, which are important in Judaism, if not just, you know, motilbash is a clear example where the Torah does not do away with males, female sex roles. Okay, this is again a very, this is another halakhic issue. We have to go into all the details of this issue. But let me just give you what I think is the bottom line. Gentile female lady, don't daven together. Don't daven together. Their battle is not to daven separately. Their battle is the what? To lead. Their battle is to lead the davening, to be the clergy. But they're not in a battle about davening. I mean, nuns daven together because they happen to be separately. They're usually, even when the nuns daven together, pray together, there's always a priest there with them. It's not an issue. Let me explain to you what I'm really saying. First, it's not mimicking the non-Jews' warnings. Second of all, even if, let's go the whole lot and say, yes, it's motivated by women's lib considerations. So what? The answer is traditionally Jewish. You don't aster, you can't aster something based on its motivation per se, okay? If the answer, if the response is a good kosher Jewish one. What the women did was a traditional, yes, the women want to do it, so they break off together and daven privately. It's very tsanua. What's wrong with that? That is, the answer is a traditional, and a framework is a very Jewish response. That's not b'chukot tamei kolekim. If they were trying to obliterate male female sex roles, they'd be going to an egalitarian service. The doctor re-emphasizing the fact that women are separate, are on the man's mind. So the charge is not a charge. I'm sure.
For sure, it would really be okay. Is that a violation of the Constitution? And if that very music, if that very music, so that's one reason why they feel like the Bible says to make a beautiful celebration. Because even if one could argue that the sensitivity of the question of the role of women came in from non-Jewish sources, the expression, the answer given, is very Jewish. That is, it allows the need, yes, but the answer we gave was a Jewish answer. So you celebrate a girl coming of age, you make a party with students, you have a bongaya, you have separate dancing, you have people giving different Torah, you make a real student mitzvah, that's a Jewish answer. Do the need come? Is there any doubt in anybody's mind that the suffragettes didn't have a role in rousing the question of the role of women in the matter? Of course they did. Of course it came from women's land in various forms. So what? It raised a valid question, and a Jewish answer was a Jewish answer. That's a decent little argument. Okay. will it be done again, again, again? Will it be accepted all? It was very passive, very subordinate. And then what's the problem? Can we now give it a real chance again? And the answer is, if it's a good answer, then it's not the hope of the answer. And that really mimics what goes on in the Christian world. All it really is, he mocks, so he smiles, and it answers and has to do something in the life. Okay, the last issue that was raised is called Ruga Batmanakimimah. So Ruga Batmanakimimah is an argument which essentially argues that the role of a Jewish woman is primarily, predominantly private, home-oriented, while a Hebrew woman is allowed to be organized and say they're having services and can they have consult and public home. Buddha, but let us see. Buddha, but the all glorious is the king's daughter within the house. Buddha, I call it Buddha. But Buddha talks about glory in the entourage. But the question is, what happens to the children of the good Buddha? But it implies glory and entourage. Of course, Buddha, but let us see. It's a pasuk in Tehillim, if I'm not mistaken. It talks about a book about nothing. Unfortunately, I don't have a source here. But it's generally used in the halakhic framework to talk about the right of a woman, the right of the woman to stay home, and not to force that into public life. Okay, let me talk about that. First of all, let's talk about whether that's an actual concept or a non-actual. Even well, this concept, of Buddha, but that's really a fundamental issue. What is the definition of what's fine? Well, the Rambam believed in Arab countries in which women really stayed at home, right? Even the Rambam was probably in the halakhic spectrum, the most strict tradition. Allowed women to go out to do mitzvah. The women have the right to leave home anytime she wanted to do, was involved in nothing else, or orphan, or she wanted to go someplace to daven, or she wanted to do some mitzvah. So, kofuda badaf kanima means time to go out and to fraternize the women in the room. Dusha already, mitzvah already, there's not a lot of talking mitzvah. Certainly no one ever argued that a woman couldn't go out to go be a shir. She said, no, she didn't have to. But Moshe Klein was embarrassing of her life with that. So I thought that. What? Right. Okay. That's a very personal thing she goes through. I'm not going to bring them together with a whole bunch of other, you know, 450 other women. That's not in the public problem. That's not in the public
problem.
That's right. So that's exactly the point. That essentially what you're arguing is that it's very difficult, certainly in the modern period, to argue for Buddha by Melanchima when women are out in the public market. I mean, no one they're in the business, in the marketplace, they're in the businesses and they're running, and the husband, you know, nobody argues that improper, so even in the radio world, only the radio world is not completely true. I mean, they're very careful, but even in the radio world, when you do go out and out in the working diamonds, and I do deal with not only the non-religious, a non-Jewish customer. I mean, I don't say that they sit there, it's free and they're always under supervision and it's very... But nevertheless, even the framework, because certainly in my consider it's right in the lady, but I would say sort of modern Buddha, and in the business world, the women are involved in all sorts of walks of life. But show you the 18 rights as far as it would also seem that the boundaries of course Buddha Bagella Kanima depend on local customs. And only in communities where women never leave their homes is behavior to the contrary considered a problem. among in our generation, religious women working in various offices, hospitals, kindergarten, schools, and their members. Well, Shalom Israeli, who's the Rosh Hashiva of the Methodist, and many, many other folks. I just follow the name doctor. But the fact of the matter is that many other folks clearly state that that's not a major problem. Or even by Malkinina, at least they're a substantial group of folks in the field that's in a model group is a matter of question. Okay, so we've essentially finished the street position, and I think that we've essentially demonstrated that with all due respect, halakhic arguments presented by the student school are less than compelling. That they certainly cannot back the women against the wall. And these are, that in each case, there's a large group of posting on which these women can rely on to disagree on every decision and every argument. The arguments are not these. But this doesn't say anything about the same issues raised are from a social perspective. I mean, splitting up in our community is a social problem. The fact that the women don't show up, sure, I'm not saying they're not a lot of problems, but it's it helps the community. The fact, what is a community? It's not shared experience. And if half of your community goes off and does something completely separate, is not in the shul, that weakens the power of the community. Okay? And a variety of other issues on a social perspective are valid issues. Kovud about Malachimima, and I mean these may not be a lot of issues, but the question is what direction are we going? Now the next position, okay, so we've now discussed Rabbora's position, we've discussed the strict position. I'd like now to talk about what I call the middle position. The middle of the road position, and that's represented by the Moshe Feinstein. Let's now read a tshuva, this is source number 17. And I should say to you that you have to read this tshuva, with your eyes wide open. Okay? And you'll see why in a second. Because what he gives in one hand gives stuff in the other. So you have to be very careful. Now this tshuva is the one that, one of the tshuvas that is most widely quoted by proponents of the women's prayer service. And you will see it as soon. You can read it yourself. You tell me what you trust it. Okay, source number 17 was reprinted in an article in Chumash. Now this is a letter that was written for Rav Moshe Feinstein, who addressed this letter. The very format of this letter was a cause of a great deal of question. Listen, I'm trying to explain to you what happened. Rav Moshe Feinstein, towards the end of the day, became very Greek, very ill. But that didn't pass the Shiloh. What happened is that they were called Mordechai Pedro, who was grandson of his Shamash, Rabban his own. He's the son of Moshe Pedro. So, I stopped there, she called that. Moshe Pedro, modern Orthodox, in the Shtapa, I think I'm calling him. His son, the Mordechai Pedro, was the Shish. Mordechai Kendall writes as follows. And he was asked the question, this was written on the Moshe's letterhead, but not finder of Moshe. So we have Chumas, I don't remember the elephant. The elephant was a nephew, a grandnephew of Moshe. He asked what Moshe said when she wrote. Mordechai Kendall answered them, and the Moshe signed the box. This tshuva is Rav Mordechai Kendall recalling what his father said. His grandfather's father. He said it was not signed to the father of the Moshe. Yidua Shitat Maris Sabbati, well known, like what my grandfather, my teacher said, in the Moshe Va'atik kan rak midrashim. I will copy here only the section 4 emphasis. It seems, when he's talking there about women, he's talking about women's liberation, he's talking about women who want to work college and be living, and he very much gets into the issue of motivation. I want to see that. אבל מכיוון שאין על הכוון הזה, since the reason why they're doing all this is not לשם שמיים, rather, אלא מצד עמותה על השם יתברך בעת הרגע, because she has a complaint with God and his soul. אין זה מעשה מצפת לה. The fact that she put on the music she was doing לשם שמיים, we can talk about it, okay? And he talks about it, he's not too happy about it, but he says, it's לשם שמיים. I can't take it away. Right? That may not have a lot of problems, but maybe. He says, that's not their motivation. They want to do these things because they have a complaint against the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Aim them master mitzvah prop. That's not considered a proper kavan to do a mitzvah. It's not considered a mitzvah action. Ela adara, maser asur, is a forbidden action. She isur de kfila, it's an action apostasy, actually, is the way you say, use it. שחושבת ושייך שיהיה איזה חילוק בדין התורה. If she believes that the laws of the Torah can be changed, כשהיא believes שיהיה איזה חילוק בדין התורה, היא עושה גם מעשה שחמיר. She's also expressing this apostasy in an action form which makes it all the more. This doesn't, by the way, syntactically is very, very difficult, and I have very much time trying to translate it. It's been translated very different ways. Anyway, the maaseh, now continues to attempt, the maaseh kasher l'mtzom mitziyud shechiseron zed lo yeh. So right off there, there's this item. He says, to be honest, de facto, he says, it's very difficult to find a situation where this should not be lacking. Ulefikach kasher lanu lagir al shum minyan nashim שאין חיסרון במעשה, and again, so there's something lacking. This is essentially, Mordechai Tendler is beginning off this tshuva by saying, I don't believe these women when they say the Lashem Shem. There's something lacking, that they have a complaint against the
Kashem.
And he calls it Minyan Shem. He calls it Minyan Shem, but he doesn't mean it in that sense. He's using that in the Ust. So remember, he's starting off very skeptical. The rak ba'ofen svara l'chud, but only based on simple svara logic. I mean, he said, let's assume, of course, that they are Lashem Shemayim. Let's see how far this takes us. The rak ba'ofen svara l'chud, eshar lahagid she'im yesh kvutzat zikaniyot shekavanatan rak l'shem shemayim, that these women are really only l'shem shemayim. And they have no complaint against God or against the Minhag Yisrael. Okay? Now that's why, as you understand, this is one of the major fundamental differences in an educational institution. An educational framework, it's instituted by the institution, it's by the teachers, it's part of the chinuch. Nobody thinks twice about it. It's clearly part of a Avodat Hashem. Nobody's out to prove anything. Okay? The Tendler says, but in a non-educational framework, are you doing it? There's an agenda. Why are the women doing it? It's not an agenda. Why would they take out the Sefer Torah if there's not an agenda? Okay? That's the argument. I don't say to like it. I present things the way the Tendler sees it. At least he went based on his conversation with Moshe. Us, if you have these righteous women, as kamuvan, mashayach l'noam l'tpavayad. Why should you let him in finish? Should we're going to die together? The gani cholot nekom the sefer Torah. Sure, they can read from the sefer Torah. Like izaru shalom lasoto b'ofen sheish litot. They should not nevertheless do it in a way that would lead one to error. To error. Shezek masik kriyat tzibur. That you should think this is a bona fide kriyat tzibur. I mean, if they want to learn from Torah, they can learn from Torah. They should not give the misimpression, or even get close to the misimpression, it's not a bona fide kriyat. Mashal. Lo tevarechna birkot ha-Torah b'faresim. They should not say the brachot of learning Torah in public. Ella, listen, what? Good point, it's clear. Just give me read another line and you'll see that what I just said to you is exactly right.
means learn the bracha that will be met in the morning. He's saying, don't delay it, but he said, don't use this patent. I'm not saying it in the morning. And then before you get out your aliyah, you'll say the two brachot before you get your aliyah, so to speak. Okay, we didn't go into the discussion, and maybe we will, about what the problems of that are. But in any case, okay, in any case, he says, don't do that. Lo tevarechna birkot ha-torah b'fahesya, ela o tesmokna al mash shebirchu b'kotem. Or they should rely on what they already made. What does that mean? They made in Shachar. Right, in Birkot HaShachar. In the Birkot HaShachar, the brachot learning Torah. But Moshe doesn't have a Havamina that you're going to make real Kriyat HaTorah brachot. Then you need a minion for. Right? That's Dabar Shabbat Moshe. You need a minion for it. He says, you can't. This is not what he's talking about. He's talking about the brachot made in the morning for learning Torah. So either you rely on what you did before, or the Mikvesh HaDayin Lo Brachu, or if you didn't, make it, do it already, to the Rechman's mother. She should do it quietly. Before she gets Aliyah, and she wants to learn Torah, she'll do it quietly. Why shouldn't she do it out loud? Because that would give the misimpression that this is a bona fide Aliyah. And Rav Moshe says specifically he doesn't want you to give that misimpression. Kemuvan, shayach od pratim, shiniflanot v'dagotenu. There are other matters which are included in our concern, lizirut binyanze, which one has to be careful about, which not give the impression, you know, the problems concern reform and all sorts of other things that he's concerned about. V'yesh l'chol bal hora'ah, and everyone who is a bal hora'ah. Now he doesn't define what's the caliber of the bal hora'ah. But when we ask Rav Kendler, how does Rav Moshe learn? I mean, one of the fundamental issues is who's qualified to pass the examination. These are communal issues. But in fact, not only your particular community, but the community around you. Who's qualified? So Rav Tendler seemed to imply that the word Baal HaRa'ah is used in Rav Moshe's Tshuvot. And we asked him, do you put the word Baal HaRa'ah in? Or did Rav Moshe use the word? I said, my grandfather used it. I said, well, what does your grandfather mean when he uses the word Baal HaRa'ah? He means somebody who ask a guna question. It's not your standard local Orthodox rabbi. It means if you're going to set policy for a community, it has to be somebody who has a stature in the community. If you have a choshev mishpat question, not even a kashrus question, a simple kashrus question, it says most local Orthodox rabbis can do it. He seems to be clearly excluding the local Orthodox rabbi. It means you need some rabbi, somebody you know, when somebody says, you ask somebody a shalai, says, you know, you got to take this to a posek. What do you need to posek? The rabbi says, we got to take this to a person. You need somebody, you know, an aguna question. You need a rabbi's rabbi in this heaven. That's what he seems to mean when he says Baal HaRa'ah. But that's a fundamental issue, by the way, which Rav Moshe didn't go into. V'yesh l'chol Baal HaRa'ah l'nhog binyan zeh v'ofen shiyatim l'shtafa zo. That will, means if the women are righteous and they want to do it, they should go ahead and do it. Right? They can go ahead and do it. In theory, of course, because he doesn't. There are such women who are not tainted by these agenda issues, says Rav Tendler, or quoting paraphrasing Rav Moshe. Kemochen, in the original response, this appears as a sort of like a P.S. at the bottom of the letter. He's not and kemochen en isur gamul isha nida l'stakel oliga b'sefer Torah. Now, it's not prohibited for a woman who is a midah to look or to touch the Sefer Torah. Ha'im shenachol machmer, even though it may be proper to be machmer, mikomogot mishpipashet shenigilot pashet. It's already common that women are not machmer in this, and when we go and discuss this, no problem for Sefer Torah. But Tendler and Moshe already said it's not a major problem. The broadcast is to be permitted. So I ask you, was Moshe matir or not?
Only in theory.
If you were to ask me, would Moshe matir, which school is he? Permissible school, forbidden school? The answer is as follows. I'll tell you what the answer is. The answer is that Moshe says in theory, yes. In practice, probably not. He's very skeptical. But Moshe leaves the door open. He leaves the door open because he refers to the Baal HaRa'ah. He says, you know, every Baal HaRa'ah should pass according to this, which means he's not it seems he says, you know, the local office, not the local office, but the local post say, should, because if there is such a group of women who are righteous, he's willing to accept the possibility. So I think that it would not be unfair to put Rav Moshe in the permissible, in the sort of middle position that permits a women's service providers done, with the caveat that he doesn't believe that such a group of women exists. What?
As it feels now, the phenomenon is that they're tempted by...
Essentially, anybody who we put in the middle position would say every... It's not that it's awesome. No, women's service, let's say, in a vacuum, are permissible. But you have to need a case-by-case determination. Okay? The question is, what weight do you put the motivation? What weight do you... Let me ask you a very simple question. This is not a tricky question. Suppose you have 90% of the women are really the Shem Shemayim's, and 10% the core Mahasins, and they want to set up a prayer group. How do you go? How do you pass it?
It's not a trivial question.
What? I mean, so you need somebody who has this pulse on the community, hand on the community, and passing. Now, let me give you a couple of names. Rav, the former Ashkenazic chief rabbi, Rav Shapira, we interviewed him. And we asked him what his position is. And generally speaking, his position is very much like Rav Moshe. He's in theory lenient, but he says you have to see what's going on in a generation. Okay. I said you have to be very careful with the give of one hand and take back with the other. Now, one who was really quite liberal on this issue was Rav Emanuel Jacobowitz and the London Beit Din. Now, the London Beit Din, in its halachic makeup, carries a lot more weight than just the Emanuel Jacobowitz. Anybody who's acquainted, you have really first-rate posting. Okay, Rav Jacobowitz, I don't mean to be done. Rav Jacobowitz is a tremendous first-class Talmud. But on the London Beit Din, you have people from a variety of backgrounds. And the London Beit Din also was pretty makeable on the issue. They had an issue about women using the Sefer Torah. They did not like the use of Sefer Torah, said use a Chumash. And a lot of this has to do with the issues. Rav Sachs, who's now the chief rabbi, has been a little careful about the permission, and again, it's seem to be a case-by-case determination about where it can be done and where it cannot be done, but Jacobus is pretty lenient on it. Rav Goren, after his retraction, Rav Goren is also first-class posting, even after he retracted, he didn't have anything against women's services. He retracted only the statement that, what, you can make contribution to Baruch Hu and all that stuff, we discussed very late, but he was not against women's services per se. And finally, one of the poskim who recently has come out in favor was a first-class Talmud Chacham, Rav Nachum Lebanitz. Rosh Hashiva of Nalek Dumin, really first-class poskim. He came out in favor of, again, on a case-by-case determination. He says you have to see who are the kochot ha-yotzvot, the po'alot. He says, yes, you can have a woman's service, but you have to know who you women are. You have to see what the issues are and what repercussions are going to be. Is there an agenda or is not? If the agenda is Hashem Shemayim, he's willing to support it.
How can they judge?
That's what I want to know. The women are being put under scrutiny then in a way that you wouldn't assume. A man gets up and down to make a change. You don't know.
What's the difference? Answer your own question.
I know.
No, what's the answer?
The answer
is a man is chayev. And a woman is a chayev. So, and again, kol hamashaneh yadol ha-tachanah. You want to come and innovate something new. Now, wait a second. It's a difference that makes a difference.
No.
And there are a lot of poskim, okay? There are a lot of poskim. There are clear major poskim who say, at least in theory, it's permissible. There are a lot of modern poskim, for the other poskim, who are willing to come out and say that you need a case-by-case determination. Rav Nachum Rabinowitz is willing to give credence to the women of Hashem Shammai. Some other posting, Rav Goren is also willing to give credence to the women of Hashem. These are first-rate posters. We can't take away from them. However, I must tell you, okay, that the issue is not trivial. We haven't yet talked about a salvation position, and that we'll talk about beginning next week.
What about the issue of Mashe'im L'shma V'Lishma? That they, maybe they had an agenda, but they come to L'shma. I think that's really between the woman and a Kaddish Baruch Hu, not between the woman and the rab.
The question is...
themselves in a position to
Excuse me. These women, let me tell you something. Let me give you two scenarios. One scenario is that the rabbi feels, right, that he has more to lose than to gain. These women come and the rabbi says no. But the woman said, we're not going to listen. We're going to go ahead and do it anyway because we feel that it's more turn. We're not, and even you admit that it's a public policy, that there's nothing us, but you think we have more to lose than to gain. The rub has a full right to go out and battle with him. He says, I won't touch you on the shore, and I will walk against you from the bima, and I won't.
Why does he have that right?
Because he feels that they have more, we have more to lose than to gain.
I'm sorry.
What makes you think that a rabbi of a community does not have to be concerned with the religious well-being of this community?
Right, but here we want this whole thing done with the halacha against it, the pressure
that. We've gone through to argue, yes, that I would argue based on the analysis that the halakhic issues are minimal. That's correct. But there aren't social issues that have to be dealt with. That the questions of do these women have an agenda? Do they really accept the burden of halakha? Are they really interested in getting closer to Kaddish Baruch Hu? Are they interested in creating a snowball effect which will push rabbis into a corner to do things that they feel are not good for Kaddish? Now I will tell you, did you see the article on Smith that I gave out last a couple weeks ago about women and feminism? The article. Yeah, I suggest that you read that article and look at it again with your eyes wide open. If you haven't got it, I have another copy. Read that article with your eyes wide open. And now I would maintain, and this is from my survey of being in this issue for 12, 15 years, that 90% of the women are Shem Shemai. 10% of the women. And what I see is that a great percent of these 10% in the leadership. And you read what they write, and you see that it's problematic. And that's why I gave you the article. Go with your eyes wide open.
You know, what you didn't bring up is what women write on this.
I suggest, because what this article does is it quotes what these women wrote. I told you that it was one-sided. Mm-hmm. But so what? So what? I'm going to say, kabel et emet mi mishalo. Accept the truth from where it comes. Yes, this article is megamati. This article is an attack. This article does not accept any possibility for change. This article is not looking, is out to prove a point. Yes, all that is true.
He has an agenda.
What?
He has an agenda.
I don't deny that. I told you that before I gave it to you.
What the women have written about.
Check in with the question, tell you? I'll tell you. Excuse me. The women who have written are reflected accurately. And I can ask, if anybody doesn't believe me, I have a library of 25 books on feminism, and you can start reading. I invite you all to read. I must tell you that the books, I do a lot of my research in Cleveland. Right, and my mother's swarm in Cleveland doesn't know where to put it. Because here I'm buying all these swarm in halacha and shuvas and right, and all of a sudden I buy from every book on women and feminists and all these wild books. He says, what are you doing? He says, after a while you get to know it. But the fact of the matter is, you have to read, and you have to be, and you have to know. I would argue that, and I think that there's a tremendous amount of pain. And pain creates very often expressions that are not necessarily balanced. I would say that a lot of these women have agendas, and these are confused agendas, because in many ways it is the Shem Shemayim. But very often, the use of term that my brother Dolby coined, it's not really Brother Dolby, but in this reference, Ahava Makalkelet et Teshuva. We know that Rashi tells us in several places that a person acts in a certain normative fashion. But sometimes extreme love makes you defer from what's proper. Extreme hate causes you to defer from what's proper.
And
we find that, for instance, Avraham Avinu is tremendously wealthy, runs out and saddles his own chamor. Or Yosef, who's greeting his father, puts the horses on his own chariot. I mean, he was the richest. Paro, he was the next to Paro. What was he doing his own chariot? You see, Bilam, the Chazal tell us, saddled his own chamor to curse him, because he was already up to curse. But it's a fourth case. There's two cases. In any case, the fact of the matter is, both are true. And I think that a person, out of these women, very often feel tremendous compassion for other women who have tremendous spiritual needs, and they want to put tricks.
But Arya, there's something that still bothers me. I was taught as a small child, and my grandfather was a rabbi, but when you get two Jews, you have three arguments. Okay?
Three opinions.
All right, but the point is that sometimes interpreting halakha, and correct me if I'm wrong, can be purely subjective, depending upon whether it's a strict interpretation or whether it's a more liberal one. So if you get two different rabbis, they're going to give you two different interpretations of the same thing. And where's the truth lie then? Because
particularly in an issue of this nature, which has ramifications.
It's purely subjective in this nature.
Well, the question is who's responsible. Look, let's hold it here. Essentially, we have one more person to talk about, which is Rav Soloveitchik's position. It's a very fascinating position. We'll talk about that, and then we'll continue on. And then, look, I haven't really answered, because I don't have, there is no easy answer. There's no easy answer. There are tremendous needs, and there are also tremendous dangers, and I think that you should,
I don't know about problem somebody outside trying to send it to somebody else.
That's because, say why you have the problem? It's because you, like me, and all of us in this room, were raised in the concept of democracy meaning personal autonomy. And that means that you have to subjugate your opinion sometimes to our halakhic framework.
What is Moshe's familiarity really with these women? He knows what somebody wrote about them. He probably didn't know them personally. He had the same with Rav Tesla.
I think that you're being afraid of Moshe. Think you're better for emotion.
No, but did he speak to them? I mean, did he know where they're coming from?
Let me put it this way. I think their emotion in his wisdom, in his tshuva, says, leaves it up to the local Baal Parah to make the determination. Because Rav Moshe is aware, and with all the skepticism, Rav Moshe is aware that these are community decisions, and they're community needs, and they have to be made by community. The question is, the charges the women have an agenda. Do the Rav Moshe have an agenda?
No, let's
keep working this through our system. If there are no easy answers, we'll continue the discussion and we'll try to finish up the discussion. Find it absolutely, completely next week. Okay.